This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're going to be discussing the topic about policy changes needed for low-income housing retrofits. Two of our presenters today are Rob Hammond with Beer Energy out in California, and then Elizabeth Hammett, who is the Director of Environmental Stewardship at EDP in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So, Rob, why don't you start us out with an introduction here, and we'll have Elizabeth second.
Sounds great. Well, this is Rob Hammond, and as Sierra mentioned, I have a company here. We do consulting. We've been driving the market toward zero net energy buildings for the past almost 20 years. And one of the issues that we've come across is low-income housing. We've had some success making low-income housing very energy efficient, but there are barriers to the market for doing that on a broad scale. I think this is important because these barriers make low-income a underserved market, and they make it impractical and not cost-effective to do. There's an increasing decrease, if you will, in home ownership, and there are things that drive the low income housing market. I'll skip over the background of all that, and describing a very successful project that we had in Lancaster, California. We reduced gas use by about 33% and electricity by 25%, and we offset 85% of the remaining electricity by using PVs. And there is a project report there. The things that we did is we air sealed the envelope. We replaced the ducts with new sealed ducts, and then encased them in insulation. We replaced all the lighting with LEDs, increased the attic insulation, put a new high R cool roof on one of the buildings, added solar hot water to one set of the buildings, and added a photovoltaic system that served the entire campus. A critical part of that was getting accurate energy modeling, and we've developed some techniques to calibrate energy models. The energy model that we use preferentially is VOPT, and we measured energy pre- and post-retrofit, and we're within about 5% of actual energy use, and we find that we can consistently reach that sort of level using our approach. With low-income multifamily, typically the occupants are tenants paying rent, and that the energy metering at Beechwood, I think, is fairly typical, which is that the individual apartments were metered for electricity and gas was master metered. The common area electricity is metered separately, and the housing tends to be old, with very little done to it, other than standard maintenance. If we looked at the simple payback for the energy efficiency PV, we found that a simple payback is about 30 years. So it's within the life of the mortgage. And if we add in, the energy efficiency alone is about 32 years. If we add PV to it, PV alone was 17 years, and then the two together was 23, which is acceptable. However, we ran into asbestos in the sealing of the units, and that was that we had to abate the asbestos just about a 10 by 10 area of the ceiling to reach the ductwork, and that moved the energy efficiency payback from 32 years to 52 years, which is obviously not workable. Some of the things that I think we need to do to alleviate some of these problems is we need to understand this is an important segment of the industry to serve, and it should be a public priority to do so, and utility funds ought to be set aside for that market specifically to take care of things like old infrastructure, old electric infrastructure that may need upgrading, or asbestos or other such problems. And the other major thing that we come across is that, of course, given the metering, that we have a split incentive situation where the benefits are accrued by the tenants as opposed for electricity savings because they're the ones with the meters. There's no reason today to be saddled with the split incentives. We should simply follow the money. The investor who pays for the upgrades, I think, should get the benefits of the upgrades. That's generally the property owner. And that can be done by estimating the energy use using a calibrated model and adjust both bills, both the tenant and the owner adjust both bills so that the improvements, the benefit for the improvements while it's being paid back is accrued to the owner. And I think that would very much improve the marketability of this sort of project. I've got a lot of data on this that we could go over, but I'll just stop there and let Elizabeth talk, and then we can discuss the viability of some of these ideas.
Elizabeth, and in case you came in late, Elizabeth is with a community director of environmental stewardship at EBP in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So, Elizabeth, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about what's happening in your area in that field?
Sure, and thank you so much for having me. As mentioned, I'm Elizabeth Hammett, and I'm the Director of Environmental Stewardship at EPB. We are a municipal electric and communications utility located in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We have about a 600 square mile area and around 170,000 meters. We are one of the larger public utilities in the United States, and we've been around for approximately 75 years. So that just gives you a little bit of context about the size of the city that we're working in and what kind of utility we are. I feel very privileged to work for EPB because as a public utility, our mission is to increase the quality of life for the people we serve. And so with that comes some freedom, frankly, to address social and economic issues. And we have been doing that really throughout our history, but just in the past several years, we've become focused on the issue of our limited income customers and the affordability of their energy bills, and especially how it relates to affordable housing overall in Chattanooga. So I would say about 2.5 years ago, the Department of Energy invited the City of Chattanooga and EPB and Green Spaces, which you may have read, I am filling in for the illustrious Michael Walton, who is the executive director of the nonprofit Green Spaces. We worked with the City of Chattanooga as well, so their director of sustainability is Eric Schmidt. And so the three of us formed a group with the Department of Energy, and you may have heard of this initiative, but it's called Clean Energy for Low-Income Communities Accelerator. And this accelerator was designed to last 2 years with various cities and counties and other types of governments joining in. And there was no money that came along with this. So the idea was that you join with your, say, city in our case, and you work together on a cross-functional team, and you have external deadlines. So the first year was all about planning. The second year was all about getting money and execution. We started with no money and, you know, a loose idea of a plan. And I am excited to say that 2.5 or so years later, we have raised over $3 million, and we have several programs that continue to do really good work. So I'll tell you a little bit about what we learned from working together and some of our programs. The program that I can really speak to the most is EPB's program. It's called Home Energy Upgrade. Home Energy Upgrade is a program that will invest up to $10 a square foot in limited income customers' homes. We focus primarily on insulation, HVAC system upgrades, sometimes replacement, and air sealing. And we found that on average, our customers save anywhere from 26 to, you know, 30-some-odd percent. That translates into over $500 annually in savings. And one of the more interesting things we found was that somewhere between 60 and 80% of our customers, depending on the year they were helped, have experienced significant health benefits. And the health benefits were things like being able to sleep through the night without waking up because it's too cold or too hot. And then on the more, I'd say, tangible scale is things like coming off of breathing machines and asthma medication. And so after we found that direct link, we investigated ways to really measure the health benefits even more. So TVA has been a key partner there. We currently have a study going that'll last 3 years that's scientifically valid that will hopefully tease out the results of those health benefits a bit more. And I know that today we're here to talk about policy, and that's one thing that had been an original idea from our group. And the way that we have tackled the policy piece, I'm just breaking and talking about that portion. We working closely with the city, the first thing that we encountered was, frankly, the folks at the top of the food chain at the city very rightly said, you know, what can we do with our current rules and regulations that are in place? How can we improve communication between EPB and the city to really identify problems? And so we went to work on that, and we're still figuring out exactly how information can flow between the city and EPB. But one big thing that EPB did that is already making a difference is in the past we have required that if renters have a high energy bill, we call them high bill complaints. So let's say a renter calls in and they have a really high bill and they don't know why this bill has jumped the way that it has. We would require that they notify their landlord and that we get permission from the landlord before we would do what we call like a high bill complaint visit. And that's where someone will physically come out to the home free of charge to the customer and investigate what might be causing that high bill. Because in many cases, especially if it is an unusually high bill, it may be something simple like their thermostat was on an emergency heat, or maybe, you know, something very simple is malfunctioning in the heat pump or in the HVAC system. And so by doing away with the requirement that they notify their landlord, we have definitely seen a significant increase in renters getting help. So I think right there that made a really big difference. And we did that about a month ago, so we're still evaluating those results. But I definitely would say for any utility that's still requiring the landlord to give permission to get on the premises, that may be a huge barrier to renters getting help for a variety of reasons. And I think our line of thinking was, well, if our customer is the renter and the customer is paying the bill, then we should work directly with our customer in this case. So that's one thing we did. And then we also are working closely with the City of Chattanooga's Community and Economic Development Group. They have a bunch of wonderful programs that help landlords upgrade their properties, and so we're working on the best way to make sure we get that information to landlords and to the renters to encourage folks to take advantage of those programs. And so that's really where we are. We also have done the first round of interviews with landlords, and we felt like it was important to be strategic and really socialize the ideas that could potentially help renters with landlords on the front end, not only to get buy-in, but also to really listen to what landlords had to say, because, you know, often you can be siloed and coming up with solutions that may not work in the real world. So we did hold 3 input sessions with landlords. And I would say that they had some pretty interesting feedback. And one thing that we heard that took me at least by surprise was that in most cases, you know, speaking to the previous speaker, landlords don't think that it's their tenant's responsibility to upgrade the home. You know, they really, at least the ones that we heard from, said that if energy efficiency upgrades were going to happen, then it really needed to be on the landlord to do that. They just may need help and support to do that. And, I mean, and naturally the idea of a stringent policy or code that, you know, forces them to do things in a certain amount of time certainly didn't feel good to them, and that makes total sense. But that there could be ways to encourage them to upgrade their homes without necessarily using a stick approach. So we did hear that. So we're very much still in the process of figuring out what works best for Chattanooga. You know, at EPB, the 2 big things that we've done recently is the Home Energy Upgrade Program. We just celebrated our 250th customer, and we're really excited about that. And we're also, you know, still very much in the process of designing programs that work for renters and landlords. So I hope that this was helpful. Feels like maybe I took a rambling approach, but I definitely hope that what I've relayed is helpful.
Definitely not a rambling approach. It's important information. So I'd like to open this up. Rob, do you have any comments on that? And then we'll open up to anybody else who would like to comment. And Chris Carrick, I see that you're online here, so you might have something to say as well.
Well, I just want to mention that I think that Elizabeth's approach makes a lot of sense for the market she's working in. I think we're working in slightly different markets, both potentially low income. I'm definitely talking low income. I'm talking multifamily buildings, and I think Elizabeth is talking single family, which makes a significant difference in terms of access to the units and the importance of dealing with the owner/landlord. I'm not sure where the in also in her case it sounded like the tenant could be making upgrades, in which case it's coming out of their wallet. And so they accrue the benefits. That works great. I'm talking about the situation where the landlord is paying for all the upgrades, but the financial benefits are accrued by the tenant, and that split incentive problem is a big barrier to getting the landlords to do the upgrades in the first place.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. And to your point, yes, most of the rental units in Chattanooga are single-family homes or duplexes. So that is a significant difference. I mean, it's in the low-income, limited-income communities. And to your point, yeah, I mean, we were thinking through that split incentive issue, and there are programs in which the landlord pays, like the pay-as-you-save models, and we were floating those to landlords to see what they thought, and it was just interesting. The feedback that we got was that they felt like it was their responsibility to provide the financing for those, but you know, but that's interesting. It was probably not necessarily representative of all landlords. So it's interesting to hear your experience. And, you know, and for us, we should maybe think through offering several different types of options and ways that rental homes can be upgraded so that you reach, you know, all types of landlords. So thank you for sharing your experience.
Any other comments? Chris, do you have anything to add to that?
I don't know if you can hear me.
No, you're all good. Yes.
Okay. So I work for a public planning agency, regional agency in Syracuse, and we're coordinating a campaign to help homeowners electrify their building heating and cooling with heat pumps. And it's a program funded by NYSERDA. And we're working in a lot of the rural areas of our region, a lot of single-family homes. But we're also running into a lot of asbestos issues, which is a huge barrier because our partner contractors can't even do the blower door test in order to see, you know, what the air exchange rate is. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what Rob's doing. We've thought about trying to reach out to USDA or to see if there's community development block grant funding available for any of the municipalities to try to address those issues first. But I'm just wondering sort of what your approach has been on those cases.
We actually have not determined a method to the right path to getting public policy assistance that would help pay for things like asbestos abatement. We've simply brought it up as a crucial element of improving efficiency in these buildings. We've come across two things so far. That's one. The other is that in the Central Valley of California, there's quite a few multifamily buildings with swamp coolers, evaporative coolers, and they're old and they can be 30 years old and they're nasty and not healthy. And they need to be replaced, but there's no way you'll ever replace them with something that's more, quote-unquote, cost-effective unless you take into account external factors such as health. So we're trying to replace evaporative coolers with heat pumps, and they can be very efficient, but they're not going to be cost-effective in terms of the replacement. When we do that, not only do we have what appears to be a not cost-effective improvement, we also find that the electrical panels are undersized to take these heat pumps. And then once we found that out, we also determined that the feeder lines to the project were undersized for the heat pumps. So now we have to change out the we have to trench and put in conduit the feeder lines at the time of construction were done per code, but that code allowed direct burial. So now we have to trench, put in conduit. The utility will put in the conductors in the conduit, but and then we put in new meter or new panels, upgraded panels, and that doubles the cost of doing the retrofit, as does the asbestos. I'm sure we'll run into other problems as well, but unfortunately, I don't have any answers as to the right way to fund these issues. But from my point of view, it could be as straightforward as if you have something like we do in California, the customer, basically the tax on all the customers to produce public goods funds, and I think some of those public goods funds should be set aside specifically to pay for things like asbestos abatement and electric system upgrades in order to make the efficiency improvements stand on their own.
Well,
one comment here. A few people apparently do not have their phones muted. I hear typing in the background, so just if you want to check on that, it would be appreciated. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, Sarah, that recently the Public Service Commission allowed NYSERDA to change some of the rules around how these projects can be financed, specifically through something we call here the Green Jobs, Green New York program. So they relaxed the rules around the, what they call the total resource cost test, essentially
mm-hmm.
the framework in which these measures have to pay back in order to allow heat pumps to be financed through this mechanism. But it's a great point. We need to perhaps relax them even further to encompass some of these health and safety measures as well. And I would just add that there's legislation being proposed here in New York called the Climate Community Protection Act, which would impose a carbon fee and mandate that 40% of the revenues go towards low and moderate income sector. And I think it's important, you know, for the advocates of that legislation to be thinking about all of these issues that we encounter in the home when we're trying to improve energy performance. So
mm-hmm.
this has been a good reminder for me to carry that message back to the coalition of folks who are advocating for that legislation.
I'd be interested to hear how that goes. If we can certainly learn from what you're doing.
Anybody else have anything to weigh in here?
This is Rick Reevesteen from Boston University, and I just want to throw in that because of the shift to accountable care, health companies now get a reward for making sure that people don't keep coming back to the hospital. So if, say, you've got an area with a lot of people visiting constantly because of asthma, it's conceivable that you could get them to pay for home improvements that would address indoor air quality. So that's a new way of thinking. I know that people in Western Mass are trying to do it. I don't know if they've succeeded, but that's another avenue to explore.
This is Tom Stanton. The person from Chattanooga mentioned that you talked with landlords about pay as you save, but then I thought in the next breath you were saying the landlords didn't want to be the ones to have to come up with the money, and those two things don't match in my brain, so I'm trying to make sure I understood what you said correctly.
Sure. So so I think what I was saying is the landlords that we interviewed about the program did think it was their responsibility, but it sounded like my fellow speaker encountered pretty much the opposite. So I was saying that I'm sure that, you know, the landlords we interviewed did feel like it was their responsibility to pay for upgrades, so they were not interested in pay-as-you-save in terms of the renters paying for the upgrades, but they may not be representative of all landlords. So that was my comment. I hope that clears
well,
up.
Well, and it occurs to me that it may be a very steep educational process to be able to fully explain to people exactly what pay-as-you-save is and why it works. We now have absolutely incontrovertible proof that it works because there are utilities that were offering side-by-side an old-style on-bill repayment program versus a new-style pay-as-you-save program. And the ability to reach the renters and landlords, you know, shows the difference. And the number or percentage of customers that take on the deal once they know what the deal is has drastically increased where that's happened. I've been a proponent of pay-as-you-save now for 15 years or more. I was a witness in a case before the Michigan Public Service Commission talking about what it is, why it's needed, and why we have to get away from the idea that utilities are going to spend 1% of their revenues on energy efficiency, and that's that. So we're now very successfully running a program that's almost pay-as-you-save. It's been running now for several years, and they've done $175 million worth of projects. I would note one utility has finally started doing it on bill, and I would note there are already some very good successes with low to moderate income people and landlords and renters. How many of you are aware of the National Low Income Energy Efficiency collaborative group that is headed up by people from Texas?
I'm not aware of it.
Okay, this discussion about how to solve these problems has been going on for at least 35 years that I know of, and we've been spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year of federal and state money, just to put Band-Aids on this ongoing problem. I know it frustrates many of us who feel like there are very well-known and proven answers that need to be implemented as rapidly as possible. I'll make sure to share back with Sierra some of the contact information that I've got. Right now, immediately, the NACIO and NARUC are working together with the NARUC Committee on Consumers and the Public Interest to try to address low-income issues yet again. Every few years this comes up, and the discussions take place with very little forward progress, but I'm always hopeful that we'll actually make some good forward progress this time around. One other idea that I had before I shut up here is you were mentioning in California the swamp coolers. Have you looked into the idea of replacing them with ice storage air conditioning?
Yes, we have. We've looked at a wide variety of replacements, but let me back up for a minute. Just to be clear, the notion of on-bill financing, pay-as-you-save, those issues are all basically financing methods to pay for cost-effective energy efficiency upgrades. And the point that I'm making or trying to make is that there are external things that can dramatically affect the cost of the upgrade, things like running into asbestos and having to abate it, or the electrical system being too far out of spec and needing to be replaced. Those are two examples of things that affect the cost of the upgrade, but are not related to energy efficiency, and the landlord is interested in doing the upgrades, but these external factors make them not cost effective and can basically kill any attempt to upgrade these buildings, and so they're outside. The costs that I'm talking about are really outside of what are normally considered as costs of upgrades.
I completely understand, and I recognize the need to be able to put together support from all different kinds of agencies to make the total package do the work that needs to be done. I know that in the Michigan Saves program, which is Michigan's version of pay-as-you-save, although it's not a full-blown pay-as-you-save yet, in that program, they do make provisions so that things that don't pay for themselves under the terms and conditions of the energy efficiency loan could still be part of a package and could still receive the low-interest long-term financing with payback on the bills and transferability of the payback so that both costs and benefits can be transferred to a new renter or a new owner when the time comes. And that can be used for things that, that don't have the payback that's necessary on a strict energy efficiency basis. So I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying and realizing that more work needs to be done on that.
Anybody else?
I have another question for Chattanooga, if you can bear it.
Sure.
And that is, what has the electric utility been doing while the gas utility in Chattanooga has been doing programming that is, let's just say, less than optimal? I did a evaluation report for the Chattanooga Gas Company so-called energy efficiency and education program, and I was truly amazed at how under-informed it was by all of the information gleaned from successful programs all over the country for the past 20 or 30 years. Somehow the regulators let this gas company come up with a really nice 1980 program to implement and gave them money to implement a program that was like just doomed to failure from the very beginning. I can imagine the electric utility could come in and do hundreds of millions of dollars of gas and water and sewer savings for fun and profit while the gas company is still trying to learn its way into the 21st century.
So I want to be sure I understand your question. Are you asking how our programs compare to Chattanooga Gas's programs?
Well, and have you thought about both tightly integrating all the programs and or have the electric utility start to compete head-to-head with the gas energy efficiency programming? Because that could be a new profit center for your electric utility.
Okay. No, I think I see what you're saying. So we typically get all of our incentives and the bones of our programs from our regulator and from our supplier, which is TVA. And for anyone who may not be familiar with that model, in Tennessee, pretty much in the entire state of Tennessee, the Tennessee Valley Authority was established in the 1930s, and power in the state of Tennessee and in the TVA Valley is all public, and we're all required to purchase 100% of our power from TVA, and TVA sets our rates and rebates and anything of that nature. So we do have an electrification incentive program right now. It's pretty new. It's less than a year old, where we do incent folks to switch from certain gas appliances to electric appliances. And there is much more of a focus on that from TVA than on general energy efficiency, although TVA has been very generous still with energy efficiency programs for limited income customers. So I hope that answers your question. I can't really speak to Chattanooga Gas's programs. We don't really collaborate with Chattanooga Gas. They're a private company. We're a public company. And we have just very different, I guess you could say we just have very different missions and very different strategies. But I hope that answers your question. I'm happy to elaborate more if you have any follow-up questions.
No, that answers it for me. I've been in this field now for 42 years, and I realize that this cross-utility work and fuel switching especially has been a third rail across the country for years and years and years, and we're just now with all the new discussion about beneficial electrification just starting to now put a toe in the water in a serious way to try to say, when there are demonstrable societal benefits, then we should allow these kinds of competition to take place in the realm of the efficiency programming.
Well, that's great to hear, and it sounds like you just have a wealth of experience, so definitely grateful for your comments.
Anyone else?
Hi, Sierra, it's Bernie Pelletier.
Hi,
I'm gonna, I just ask a question. This is a very new field for me, so it might be totally off base. If so, just tell me that and I'll be quiet. My question is, when you all look at these low-income housing units, do you look at them individually on a case-by-case basis, or do you have a perspective of them in total? And the reason I'm asking is if you had a perspective of them in total, then you could maybe realistically go at it with like a 10-year or a 15-year sort of methodical approach that you would get through every building in such and such a time. And things like asbestos, things like mold, things like health concerns, which aren't going to be solved in an economic framework, could be addressed sort of in a subsidy framework if you sort of knew the whole pot. So the question is, do you think of this holistically for all the Chattanooga low-income housing, or do you think of it as they come to you for help?
That's a great question. So I would say that a holistic view is beginning to emerge more and more, but it really is, as you mentioned, highly individual. So we do a site visit for each customer that either calls in or fills out an application, and we write what we call as an individual energy prescription. So we have a pretty good idea of what most homes need, but as you mentioned, each home has different problems. I know one thing we run into a lot is still active knob and tube wiring. We also run into issues of mold. I have not heard of issues of asbestos from anyone in the field, thankfully. So each home and its issues are really highly individual, and we have about the same amount of money for each home. So it's about moving it into different areas to make the program work in each home. As far as being methodical, I mean, we definitely track the data very methodically. And for those who don't know, we do have a fiber optic smart grid, so we are able to measure energy consumption. We measure it currently in 15-minute increments. So we have a really great picture of energy consumption in the home, and are able to tailor a plan based on individual usage patterns as well. To answer your question, just bluntly, I would say that it is definitely a case-by-case basis, and we still are trying to tease out what we call, like, statistically valid trends. You know, we're still looking to see, well, if you spend this much per square foot and 40% of it's in insulation, is it this much better or not? I hope in the next few years we'll have broader trends, and there's a wealth of data out there. But for our general area, especially most low-income renters living in single-family homes, it does get highly individual.
Gotcha. Thank you for that answer. I'll get just one sort of add-on is things like knob and tube, certainly that one. You might be able to identify that in your aggregate housing stock just by the year of construction, which I'm going to guess is a field that you might have overall. And once you said, okay, we have 2,500 of knob and tube where we suspect knob and tube is a problem, it might allow you to say to an electrical contractor, look, we've got this many homes. We know we have to remediate this. How about you? We can give you 3 years of good solid work, but how about you give us a break on the price? So some sort of, once you aggregate things, we might be able to argue with vendors for breaks based on volume and continuity of work.
Well, great. That's a really interesting concept, and we can definitely discuss it. Currently, we usually pass on homes with extensive knob and tube, but that may make it more cost efficient. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
That last question, this is Tom again, that is an area where there's a lot of work going on and people trying to figure out how to combine together the financial instruments to create what might be called a real estate investment trust opportunity. And I know that there's a company in New York City that's been doing multifamily buildings on something like a pay-as-you-save mechanism. It's not on the utility bill per se, but they were pretty successful at combining together a whole bunch of buildings so that they could provide financing to the millions of dollars rather than the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so that kind of aggregation makes a tremendous amount of sense. As it happens, the National Coalition for Community Capital is holding its annual conference in Detroit this year, and I'm going to be on the panel that's discussing energy project financing. And then we're going to hold a separate side meeting about that, talking with those states who are trying to establish crowd equity, crowd investing for energy efficiency financing. I know of one success at that already in the state of Vermont, and this company that I mentioned from New York City, and I'll be trying to gather all the case study information. We know that, for example, there are co-ops already doing community solar projects in Wisconsin, Minnesota, I think Indiana is another one. So, you know, the legal pathways to organizing so that we could gather together large sums of money and put them into these kinds of investments, even in low income, you know, wherever these investments will pay for themselves through accumulated energy savings over time, it's a very real possibility.
Thank you.
One question. I would assume that a lot of the cost of the energy efficiency improvements would be in labor as much as materials. That be the case?
Yeah, I think it's about 50-50.
Yeah, it's often a very big piece. And one thing we know for certain is that if you're in a fuel importing state, which most of us are one way or another, then one of the worst things you can do for your state economy is build central station power plants or natural gas infrastructure, because the ratio of millions of dollars spent to jobs created and maintained is really very bad for those kinds of projects. And we know it's very good for energy efficiency and for small-scale distributed energy, like on a 2-to-1 to 12-to-1 basis. So, you know, for anybody who's interested in long-term economic benefit, they should be chasing all cost-effective energy efficiency as fast as possible, and then all cost-effective distributed energy as fast as possible. And the last thing they would ever want to do is build a central station power plant or a transmission line.
That's important information. I'd like to talk to you more about that, Tom.
Yeah, I'll just say the Avengers final chapter is this weekend, I think, and I'm going to make a vote that we put you in as one of the new Avengers based on that comment. You don't know that. It was a compliment.
Well, I'll find out. I think my wife is taking me to the movie on tonight, I think, or no, tomorrow night.
Congratulations.
All right. Any other thoughts here?
I have one question. This is John from West Coast Solar Company. I'm wondering, given the emphasis on low income and the move toward, you know, cleaner electrification, are there any moves to establish metrics or benchmarks on the low-income side for utilities to monitor and then examine low-income usage of electricity per square foot or per some metric where they are rewarded for reducing the high density of energy use in low-income areas?
That's a really interesting question. So I think, you know, as the utility here, I can tell you that we definitely do have that metric in terms of consumption by square foot, and it's very detailed. In terms of rewarding certain segments of our customers for usage drop, I don't think that's something that we are currently allowed to do, just given our public utility nature and how our rates are set. But it certainly is an interesting concept. But we definitely have data that shows that not only do renters tend to consume more per square foot, but renters in certain areas of our city consume more per square foot than other renters.
And I was actually thinking that the utility would invest in reducing energy use in low-income areas because they already have programs to deliver low-cost electricity to the low income. So that's almost a lost leader item. If they can reduce the amount of energy that's used in those areas by capital investment or by shared capital investment, then it sort of makes sense.
Well, if I understand your comment, which I'm not sure that I do, are you saying that, I'm not familiar with this, it sounds like other utilities have different rates for different socioeconomic groups?
Yes, they certainly do in California.
Oh, okay. Well, we in the Tennessee Valley, we do not do that. Everyone pays the same residential rate. So that's not an option here. But we do invest in low-income areas through really the Home Energy Upgrade Program. And that's an investment that there's no return on except for the community investment return and our contribution to trying to make the housing stock more affordable.
I see. So in order for that to be a viable option, you would have to have, I mean, maybe this is an argument for outside the topic, but an argument for some sort of CO2 tax or carbon tax. Because then what I'm trying to get to is incentivizing the supplier of electricity to also be an investor in reducing its use or the density of its use.
Yeah, I mean, I think the concept of a carbon tax in Tennessee is certainly an interesting idea. I don't know how politically viable it would be or how exactly that would work. I think in our case, that would certainly have to come from the federal level, which isn't, you know, impossible. And, you know, and as it stands, TVA is a federal agency. And so if they were to have a directive to implement some sort of carbon tax, then that would become a reality for us. But in the absence of some sort of national policy or federal directive, I don't think that would be an option for our service territory, however helpful it would be to have outside incentives. I think we're always looking for things that we can do within the constraints of our structure, and certainly we really are investigating every option with community partners. But that is interesting, and I think California and other states that have, we'll just say, more progressive policies tend to have more options and more flexibility in how they can make the business case work. So a little jealous of you guys, I'll say that.
Well, we may have more options. I'm not sure we're any better at it.
That's funny.
I think that idea about financial incentives that would go to the utilities is very important, and I will bring it up to the Nehruk Ignacio group that's starting to meet May 8th as the first of a series of webinars about disconnections and delinquencies in bill payment, and then what all the different states are doing about that. So I know that there could be some metrics already around uncollectibles and numbers of customers that are delinquent in paying their bills. But I think you're absolutely right. If we had some kind of metric that rewarded the utility for achieving exemplary energy efficiency at a particular rate of speed, you know, that makes a tremendous amount of sense and might be necessary to attract the utility's attention that this is a good thing to do. And without it, you know, then the utilities unfortunately still have this idea very often about what it means to lose sales because customers get more efficient. I think that they're totally mistaken in their understanding about what it does to their economics, but they still hold that kind of view.
Well, we have a couple minutes left here still. Any last thoughts?
Well, Sierra, this is Chris again. I'm very interested in this idea of a progressive tariff structure. It's an idea that I've raised in several commission forums here in New York. But then I'm also struck by the comment that renters tend to use more electricity per square foot or by some measure. So it seems like that would be contradictory to the aim of what I'm looking for. So I don't know if this is something maybe for a future call to explore that a little bit further. I'm not sure how California is doing that, if I understood the comment correctly. You know, if they're basing that on socioeconomic status somehow or energy use intensity or by what measure, but it could be an interesting approach to incentivizing utilities to do the right thing and to raise more funds for the things that we know we need to do.
No, we definitely can have that in a call. Anybody else? Well, we have a couple minutes left, so if there are no other comments right now, we'll go ahead and end. And sure appreciate everybody for coming. Thanks for Elizabeth and Rob to starting this discussion and everybody else for contributing. It's certainly an important one. So next call is going to be next week on the 30th, I believe, and we're discussing the advanced energy communities. Anybody who has an interest in that, please attend. And webinar on May 2nd, talking about, Rob is going to be talking about the same topic we just had today as far as policy changes for low-income housing. So thanks again, and you know, let me know if you have any ideas. I appreciate the one you just gave, Chris, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thanks, everyone.